Well, good evening, everyone. Yeah, it just occurred to me while Gordon was talking there that if any one of us took 40 years in our life, it would probably be a whole career. You know, if you take an average lifespan, you take, 20 years for adolescence and whatever else you have to do before you're 20, and then you have some time for retirement, there aren't too many of us that have more than a solid block of 40 years. So that would be our defining years, I think, and would be essentially our career. Now, Moses, of course, had three of those. And I think it's a testament. And what we've been trying to do is to talk about Moses himself more than all the other issues around him. But how this affected Moses. Moses himself was a very strong person, obviously. What we can attribute that to, I don't think we're told, but he certainly was. So we did divide these 40-year periods up into three, one of them being the first 40 years being entitled Thinking He Was Somebody. The second 40 years being realizing he was nobody. And the third year, 40 years, discovering what God can do with a nobody. And I think we need to take great encouragement from this, because in many situations during Moses' life, he had to come back to the reality that the Lord had a job for him to do, and he was quite qualified. In fact, he was eminently qualified to do that job. And he was self-deprecating. He tried to, whether he believed it purely or not, tried to say that he wasn't as good for the particular task that, that God had. But at the end of the day, he was, of course, capable of some very great things. Now, Moses, in terms of the biblical record, second to the Lord Jesus Christ, and we may just make a reference to that a bit later, was the most influential person within the biblical record. Now, maybe that's not totally correct to say that, but I think if we look at the effect of what we call the 66 books that we call the Bible, the effect on the world today, then Moses would certainly have to be the most influential person biblically. So next to Christ. So what I've tried to do here in this presentation is to break down Moses' life into some important things that he was related to and he was associated with. And one of them, of course, is the law. So when we think of Moses, we think of the law. Secondly, the tabernacle. And the tabernacle bit is shorter than the law bit, for some reasons that we'll discuss in a moment, God willing. Thirdly, the wanderings. Now, the wanderings were really how, in relation to how the wanderings affected the people. And the fourth bit is entitled The Border of the Land, and we'll come to Deuteronomy 31 to have a look at that and to see what the situation was when they got to the border of the land, and then going on to Deuteronomy 34, which I'm going to call an epilogue, really, in that there's a bit of a summation there of some important insights that take us back into the life of Moses. And in the box on the right, on the second page, is a very good quote from Brother Harry Tennant in his book, Moses, My Servant. And God willing, we'll have a look at that in a little more depth as we close this evening. Now, first of all, the Ten Commandments. And I think sometimes we have to stand back, like we did and we do in our Bible seminars, to have a look at the big picture. Jesus clearly sums them up in Matthew 22 and verse 34 by saying that the Ten Commandments are really two. And that makes things very, very simple for us, because the first five had to do with this central fact in Israel and the world that there is one God and that he requires our total focus and worship. So the first five commandments have to do with God and with the focus that he requires and he expects of people. The second five have to do with how we relate to our neighbors. So the first five, as Jesus sums up, are about loving God, and the second five are about loving our neighbor. Now, I don't like to sort of take the whole of Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, or the largest portion of Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, and say it all boils down to these two comments, this summation by Jesus. But in fact, it does. If we took those two, as you'll notice about the fourth bullet down, where I've made this comment, that the Ten Commandments alone, as a piece of work of Moses, that Moses hands over to the world, the Ten Commandments alone could rid the world of unrighteousness and bring prosperity to all mankind. If you could think of any nation that has ever lived, any group of people, any society that has ever existed, and apply the two commandments to them, it would work. All the rest of them would be somewhat less worth. Now, when we need to, I think, have that focus, because really Moses understood that. And in a couple of very, very clear comments, and mostly coming out of Deuteronomy, as he reflects back upon what this was all about, he says in chapter 30, well-known verse, verse 13 and 14, "The word is very near you. It is in your mouth and it is in your heart, so you may obey it." So you could have all the temples that you wanted. You could have all the tents of meeting and the arks of the covenant and the lavers and the altars and the lambs and the blood and all of that. But if it failed to impress upon the heart, then it was of no value at all. And primarily, brethren and sisters, when we are applying the law, it has to be in our heart to be valuable. So it must be near us. It's not in some, as he says in chapter 30, it's not up in heaven. It's not way down in the earth. It's not in some other exotic part of the earth that you know, requires some great effort to find it. It's not in the water below, and so on. It is a simple reality that is near you. It's there, and it's in your heart. It needs to be there. And I think for me, just going out this last weekend and hanging around the Bible exhibition and just talking to folks that came in, there were a number of themes there. One of the main themes that I found, and I think most people who are out there find this, is that people, first of all, are a bit standoffish. They don't want to really engage you. Secondly, they want to try and denigrate the text itself. So in other words, it might be a good piece of history. It might have some interesting history attached to it. But really, it is so full of mistakes and translational errors. And as a friend of mine who wandered in was trying to convince me that there were all kinds of other texts as well, you see. So people like to say that to try and depreciate the word and the simplicity of the word and the reality of the fact that we have this consistency, and it's summed up very well in what Moses is saying. People don't want it too near. I think that's the problem. We don't. Just naturally don't want it too near. We don't want it in our mouth because a lot of other stuff in our mouth. And we really don't want it to be a systemic within us in our hearts, because then we have to deal with this thing called obedience. We have to obey it, as Moses said, and that's something that the human mind just has a problem with. And I think when you follow the argument out with the people who come into the exhibition, and give them credit, they came in. That's really what's behind this thing. You know, I got to commit, I got to do something, and I'm busy, and I got stuff I'm doing, and really, so that's very nice for you, and so on. So we go to Deuteronomy chapter 6, and this is emphasized. Now, again, Moses emphasizes this over and over. So these are just two verses that I've pulled out. 6 verse 6, "These commandments that I give you today are to be upon your hearts." So that's fine to have a tabernacle. It's very nice. And it was all done according to the way God had shown Moses on the mount, as Exodus 35 or 25 tells us. And the writer in the New Testament tells us the same thing, that there was a specific reason for doing things a certain way. And That wasn't the point. The point was that at the end of the day, it had to be a matter of the heart. And I think that is central to Moses, even though we have this whole body of law, which is the most workable, righteous body of laws that the world has ever seen and will ever see. So it's a matter of the heart. Now, of course, it's okay to have them as a matter of the heart, but the thing is that there's a certain action that has to come from it. There's an obedience that follows from our understanding of the truth and of these simple truths. We have to follow them, and there is an assurance. There is, in fact, a covenant that goes with this, that if you follow them, you will live by them. Now, it's not like saying, okay, well, these are the things that you live by, and this will give you a good life. It's that if you obey and you follow, then you will have life as a result of them. And there was all kinds of reasons why that was true, not the least of which that Moses said when they crossed the Red Sea, that he said that none of these diseases that you saw the Egyptians had, and you lived with all this disease in Egypt. We talked about that on the first night. Egypt was full of disease and full of all kinds of crazy cures for diseases. But you won't have any of these if you follow these laws. If you live by them, you're going to have a good and healthy and prosperous life. So there is a cause and effect here. Now, how we see that being worked out in our own lives probably is within the kingdom of God on earth. But we must not depreciate the fact that if we live according to the righteous truths of the law, as Moses laid down, and really the summation, we're going to have a prosperous, healthy, well, righteous life. And Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 7, this is something that you really have to keep in mind as well, because what other nation? And they'd had an opportunity to see Egypt and all of the effects of health care and all of that and the crazy kind of death religion of Egypt. What other nation to that point or for that matter ever had such great laws as these? That they could have righteous laws that would bring them prosperity and they could live by them. What other nation is so great? Now, having said that, and if you take these ideas out of chapter 4 of Deuteronomy, there is a progression of thought. And as a matter of fact, we start with Deuteronomy chapter 1 and go right through the first 5 to 7 chapters, and this theme persists right through them. But there is another consequence to this. And again, this comes back to the heart, I think, of discussions we have with our neighbors and friends and the folks at the Bible exhibition. Because we have truth, because we have righteousness, because we have good laws that are right and they're divine, we have to watch ourselves closely. Now, again, this comes back to the heart of the systemic problem that we all share with humanity, the common problem with humanity. Do not forget. So from the very beginning, Moses is saying, all of this brings with it a sense of self-examination. So in your heart, you have to look at the law and you have to constantly examine yourself. And that, of course, is a theme that comes right through into the New Testament. The greatest challenge that we have, it's all very well to have this wonderful book and these laws and these Ten Commandments and all of that, but unless it projects into a self-examination and unless it projects into the fact that we live by these things and we don't forget them, it's all of no avail. So the greatest challenge is self-examination, and this in relation to the law of God. And also, when we think about that, the two great commandments, the first of all, worshiping God and focusing on God and only God, that is the first great challenge. And then secondly, sacrificing ourselves so that we can be concerned about our neighbors and look after our neighbors, that is the second great challenge. So worshiping God and not ourselves is all wrapped up in those two pieces of the great summary of Jesus. Two things that human beings are not necessarily naturally willing to do. And that means worshiping God, the Creator, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of Moses, and his laws, and nothing else, to the exclusion of all else. That is to say, ourselves as the number one idol that is normally set up, and all the other things that we make that we can worship, or that God has made, that is to say, the bits and pieces of creation, as the Egyptians did. They worship cats, or they worship cows, or they worship this, or they worship that. All not to be worshipped, but all things that people naturally tend to want to worship. That is the basis of idolatry. And of course, they made a calf. Right? So there's two things that happened. One was it was a calf, and secondly, they made it. And somebody said, well, these are the gods that you had in Egypt, and these are the gods that brought you out of Egypt, which is the great lie that continues within our experience to this day. Now, the other great thing that happened was that God, in verse 34 of Deuteronomy chapter 4, says, or Moses says, has any other God ever tried to take for himself one nation out of another? Now, I guess we could see that certain groups of people have kind of split off and formed and so on, but this was a conscious effort to remove a whole group of people, maybe a million people, out of a great nation, a nation that had the strength to keep them there, but to pull them out of it, not by some chance or because somebody rose up who happened to be able to have a leadership qualities to lead them out, but because he had promised to Abraham in Genesis chapter 15 that he would do so, and that he would do so after about 400 years. So that was the great miracle of it. Not that some nation just happened to form and kind of morph out into some other nation, but the fact that this was a plan of an eternal creator that says, I'm going to do it in 400 years and I'm going to pull them out, and this is what's going to happen, and it did. So that is true. There's no other incident in the history of the world like that. The Lord is God in heaven, above, and on the earth below. There is no other. Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 39. There is no other God. No other God could do that. No other God would give that nation that he pulled out of Egypt such laws. No other God would be prepared to dwell with them and write it into their heart so that they could live by it and prosper by it. It was completely unique. Now, going through sequentially here, there's the cities of refuge. Now, this was part of the law, and so in terms of administrating the law, there's great grace and mercy in this, and it's written in all the way through here, and there's a number of other areas where we hope to just pull this out as we move through. The cities of refuge, we all know, were chosen around the land in close proximity to population growth areas, and they were there so that people could flee there if they were concerned about justice being done or about some court case or something that had happened. So there was a place that people could go. The place that people could go offered them an opportunity of time. There is a case of manslaughter. There's a case of murder. There's a case of something dramatic like that. People had the right to go to the city of refuge to find some respite while these things were sorted out. Now, that, I think, stands opposed to probably the habits of summary execution that went on probably in most other nations and peoples of the day and continue to go on in the Middle East today. So rapid summary execution. This didn't happen under the law. There was room to discuss, to ponder, to apply the law, and so on. Now, of course, that sets up, and we look at the law itself, it sets up all kinds of lessons for us and things that we need to understand, like, for example, that we all need a city of refuge. There needs to be somewhere that we can find that type of relief. And it was part of Moses' law that brought that about. No other nation, I'm sure that was true of the City of Refuge, had such mercy and justice written in to the law. Now, there's also other responsibilities, of course. One of them being that the system of Moses was a patriarchal system. And so you have families within the patriarchal system. It was about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And about families, and about families that got together and had Passover and left Egypt. And it was about the numbering of families and heads of fathers, fathers who were heads of houses and so on. So it was about family. And it was within the family that the law really was expressed and taught. The primary area where these truths were impressed upon the children. And it says, impress them on your children. Because in verse 20 of chapter 6, of Deuteronomy chapter 6, kids always say, how come? How come we're doing this? How come we have to kill these lambs? How come we have this thing at the tabernacle? How come the priests do that? And how come we have cities of refuge? And children have every right, and they must ask those questions. And we as parents and as grandparents have the obligation to make sure that they're answered according to the experience of the nation, according to the law. So that always had to be there. And there's this incident that comes up at Meribah, which we read about tonight, which was 38 years on from 35 plus years on from the initial providing of these laws. But the fact was that the kids had to know that they were slaves in Egypt. And that was not a very good thing. And if you were a dad and you'd made bricks and had to deal with Egyptian taskmasters, you really needed to let your kids know that so that they could see the clear difference between the order of the Israelite camp, the presence of God, and the comparison with what they had put up with in Egypt. And I think one of the, and they didn't do that, okay, and we'll get to that, God, only in a few moments, but I think that's one of the things that we as parents and grandparents often fail to make clear to our young people, and that is that they were dying in Egypt. That was a very bad place to be. There was no hope in Egypt. It was a land of graves and death. There's only hope with the people of God in the promised land. That is what we have to somehow impress upon our children. Now, another principle, chapter 6, verse 10, cities you did not build. Now, these are eternal truths because people who win the lottery generally, I mean, if you look at the history of people who win great sums of money in the lottery, generally it messes up their lives. It destroys their lives. People are not enriched by inheriting things that they didn't have to work for. But here this whole nation was going in with a bunch of young people going in now to a land that had roads, that had bridges, I suppose, it had walls, it had vineyards, it had olive yards, it had farm areas that were set up for grain, it had flocks and herds and horses and everything that they needed. It was all there, nice houses. These Canaanite nations were fairly well-developed nations, and we even have archaeology that tells us that, going back to the layout of their houses, the size of their houses, and so on. These weren't poor wilderness wanderers. It was really the people of Israel were coming out of the wilderness, living in tents, moving around 40 times. Numbers 33, I'll come to that in a moment. 40 times they lifted up the camp and moved in 38 years. Now they were just going to wander into these cities that had already been built. And that is a very heady thing. It's a very, very dangerous thing. You know, if we don't put sweat equity into what we do and what we have, whatever that is in life, we don't value it as highly. And that is what Moses is now telling them. You have to let them know that this is a gift and they don't want it to go to their head because that's going to mess up life faster than anything. Now, God did not choose you, verse 7 of chapter 7, because you were more numerous, which raises some issue about the numbers of the people of Israel, which is not really my point to talk about that tonight. But because the Lord loved you and because of the covenant that he made. So you could say, well, I'm part of this miracle nation. I'm an Israelite. And they did after a while when they had the temple, because they were doing bad things in the temple, and the prophet said, no, the temple's going to be destroyed. And they said, no, you can't do that. This is the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. Remember, they said that to Ezekiel and to Jeremiah. God won't, this is his temple, he won't destroy it, even though we're kind of, you know, worshiping Babylonian idols in the temple. This is the temple, God's not going to do that. So there is a problem that we can get into very quickly, which is spiritual self-righteousness. And I know some folks that are good friends of mine who are the evangelical, of the evangelical persuasion, where they say that once saved, always saved, right? So what you do is you accept Jesus as your Savior, and then suddenly you enter this kind of spiritual sense of eternity, simply because you did that. And life isn't really that, important in terms of watching and working so much. So we can get into the situation where we think, well, we are the people of the Lord. We've been baptized. We go to the meeting and so on. And we forget that this is all because of mercy. We're here not because we're great, not because we're righteous, but because God is righteous and God is merciful, and because God is a covenant God, and he's made a covenant, and he said he will do it, and he will. That's why we're here. So it's very easy for us to get off track on that. Spiritual self-righteousness is a clear and present danger, ever-present danger. Those are just exhortations that we could, you know, could have from time to time. Now, getting back to the law. Now, Moses was a man of justice, a man of righteousness, and a man of compassion. And so strangers, widows, orphans, fatherless, aliens, and so on, come up again and again in the law. Exodus 22, Exodus 23, Deuteronomy 10, Deuteronomy 17, and so on. You can find this refrain throughout the law. So therefore, they as Israelites, who had these great laws and these great blessings, and had been the recipient of God's mercy and God's deliverance from Egypt, and who themselves had been slaves and knew what it was like to be strangers and aliens in a foreign land, needed to treat the strangers and the orphans and the widows properly, with justice and with righteousness. And if they didn't do that, it was all for nothing. Now, the sad part of that is that when we come back to the major prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and all the minor prophets, this was something they didn't do. And it was early in the message of Isaiah, and the earliest of the major prophets, right up in the first few chapters. The problem was, they weren't taking the law and applying it to the widows, the orphans, the strangers, and the poor. They were taking advantage of them. And so therefore, they had transgressed the spirit, if not the letter of the law. And unhappily, they didn't get it. And that's, again, a frightening thing about the hierarchical ideas that human beings have, that they could do those things and still call themselves Israelites. Oh, and the tithe. The tithe was something that was part of the law, and we know that the tithe was civil income tax. It was how the community got by and paid for the bureaucrats, the civil servants, who were the Levites and the priests. So therefore, you had to devote some type of a tax. And in a way, it was kind of like a flat 10% tax, which if we had that today, we'd all say that this is great. It was a not an onerous tax, but it was a tax. It was so that the Lord's community could be maintained, so that people who were called Levites and priests could actually have a full-time job looking after the people, and the people would look after them. So there was certainly the tithe brought in for that. But it also was brought in because God's people need to understand that they've got to give back. And I think that the whole mentality of the nation of Israel should have been founded on that. We have these blessings. God does these things for us. And so therefore, we have no choice but to give back. Now, there was certainly the flat tax and the tenth and all of the different things that they were supposed to give back were the base line of tax. And that didn't preclude them from going beyond that. And we can certainly see, even with the prophets and many other situations in the Old Testament where people were clearly went beyond that. You know, people like Job and so on, who were benefactors and saw their job to give back. Now here's the mercy of it all. The last bullet here under the law, for he brought us out, said Moses, chapter 6, verse 23, to bring us in. God didn't bring them out so they could die in the wilderness, and they thought that he had. They argued about that and complained about it. He hadn't done that. He brought them out of Egypt because he wanted to bring them into the land that he had promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and he wanted them to be the light-bearing nation of the world so that he had a spot all picked out there. It happened to be in the city of Jerusalem. He talked about it, where his name was going to be, and that was the most important part of the land, but he was bringing them in. He had no intention of leaving them out. He brought them out so that he could bring them into the land that was promised on oath to your forefathers. So that's kind of a summation of how I see, just in brief, the law and the wonder of it all. Now, the tabernacle, and I mentioned this last week, we had this opportunity a couple of weeks ago to see this Messiah's mansion that was set up down here off Quadra in Chatterton. And it was really kind of fun because, as I said, you know, you had the sense that of the size of it and the dimension of it and the height of the poles and how the thing went together and how it could be disassembled and moved. And they had a video there that showed how they wrapped this thing up and shoved it into a 40-foot trailer, which they didn't do in the wilderness, of course. They packed it. But it was all disassemblable. It was all you could put it into pieces, and then the Levites wrapped it up and carried it. They had to do that because, as I said before, Numbers chapter 33 tells us quite specifically that it was set up and moved and reset up 40 different times. It kind of gives us the stations of where they went. So this was 38 years, 40 times. We don't know whether this was exactly, you know, every 11 months that they moved, or there was sometimes they moved faster. How long it would take to move a million people, if that's what was happening in the wilderness, to set it up, take all their tents down, set it back up, and move. This was quite a logistical feat. And Moses was up for that as a leader because he'd moved great armies down into Ethiopia and probably right across to Midian, the very land that he had the people on. There was a pattern, and that pattern was there, and it was the pattern of the Messiah and of the future temple of the Lord. It was the pattern of teaching Israel civil order and holiness. And if you said, well, okay, here they were in Egypt, they got to come out of Egypt, God was bringing them out, was going to organize the nation, teach them in the wilderness, and then bring them up into the land, then this tabernacle was absolutely essential to creating focus. And it had to have an entry where the priests went in, where there was a daily sacrifice going on in the morning and in the evening. There had to be incense rising from this area to let the people know that blood was being shed, that a sacrifice was being made, and that the laws of God were based upon sacrifice. They had to understand that there was another building in the middle that was a holy place where the priests went into the presence of God and did the Lord's work daily and weekly, trimming the lamps and changing the showbread and so on. They had to also understand that beyond that, there was another curtain that the high priest only went in once a year, and there was the Ark of the Covenant. And that veil would have to be ripped apart someday, symbolically. Not that particular one, but the veil of the temple that separated man from God would one day have to be ripped apart when the perfect sacrifice was made. And of course, that all was there, prefiguring it exactly as it had been shown in the mountain. But it provided a basis for a portable center for the nation to focus on. Now, a few thoughts on wandering. Why did they wander for 38 years? Because they made a bad choice, and they could have gone in sooner, but the nation really wasn't kind of lined up properly at the time anyway. So it took that length of time to kind of purge out, you know, with hindsight, kind of purge out all the old guys that weren't too quick in the head and thought that maybe there was something better in Egypt. And the ones that most of them had been actually brick makers and hewers of wood and drawers of water and straw and so on in Egypt, for them to all die off in the wilderness. But it made some sense, I think, in hindsight, because they just weren't ready. The nation wasn't ready at that time. So anyway, God humbled them. Chapter 8, verse 1, Moses said, "He humbled you, causing you to hunger and thirst." Now, you have to get hungry before you understand what being full is, I guess. And I had a colleague a number of years ago who was Irish, and I might have told you about him before. And in Ireland, they'd had a bit of a, in the 80s, a bit of a renaissance, a financial turnaround, and they got hooked in with the EU and Germany and so on. And Ireland had a bit of an economic resurgence. And I said to him, "Well, you know, how come the Irish are suddenly they're just working and they're really producing and the economy of Ireland's going up?" And he says, "Well, Clyde," he says, "they know what it's like to be hungry and they're not going to be hungry again." And I think that's really the lesson, isn't it? That when you're hungry, and we've never probably ever been hungry, then we understand what we need to do to make sure that we're not hungry again. So God humbles us. He takes away our food and he takes away our water so that we can understand that we have to rely on him. We have to understand where the water comes from and where the food comes from. And that's why he did that. And know in your heart, in chapter 8, verse 5, that it's the same way that you discipline a child. You have to have certain privations for a child so that they understand the difference. And that's exactly what God did with Moses' help on the ground, to test you. But remember, the Lord your God, it is he who gives you the ability to produce wealth. And that's something that is so easy to forget. You know, like you're going to inherit houses that you never built. You've got to give the tithe back. And it's like saying, "Excuse me, so where'd the money come from?" "Oh, I can't afford that because, you know, it's 10% and all of that. I got to pay my taxes." Who gave you the money to begin with? Remember the Lord your God. It is he who gives you the ability to produce wealth. He blesses you with his laws and you respond to them and then you're wealthy. Not because you're smart, but because God gives you that ability to do that. And so confirms the covenant. That's the covenant between Israel and God, between us and God. He swore it to our forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And it's the same today, he says, to this very day. Their clothes didn't wear out, and their feet didn't swell. Now, this was interesting because a lot of their parents did wear out. 70 years, they were all gone. That whole group from 20 years old and upward were all dead when we get to Numbers chapter 26. And Moses numbers the people. And almost like we're saying, okay, is there anybody left here? Numbered them all up, all the tribes, and wrote them all down. And their shoes were as good as the day they 40 years old, shoes. And I just had a pair of shoes resold that I've had for 2 years, and the sole was all gone. So these never wore out. Their feet never swelled up from walking. 40 times they picked the camp up and moved it. Never swelled. They all died in the wilderness, all counted in Moab. Specifically counted. We were counted at the beginning, remember. And they were counted at the end. And if we look at the numbers, it's kind of interesting because there's not a whole lot of difference between those numbers. But so all those people died and a whole new generation came up. Now let's go back to the sidebar, because I've put the term rebellion over the sidebar, because it seemed to me that as I looked at Moses and his leadership in the last 40 years of his life, that there were a number of things that were important to our understanding of Moses' leadership and Moses' position between the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and his people, the children of Israel. Now, the golden calf was the first major event. Well, there were some water issues and so on in manna, but the golden calf on the mountain And I say the golden calf was a big event because that was a transitional event. It overshadowed the tables of stone that came down that were initially broken. The golden calf was a big event. Now, I can't imagine how literally ticked off I would be if I came down that mountain and these people were doing that. And we're only talking 40 days or whatever. It wasn't. And from the time that the Red Sea was parted, it was in their recent memory. And some joker standing there saying, "These be your gods, O Israel." It's almost unbelievable until we stop and think about, you know, the human condition. Now, there's an exchange that goes on between Moses and God. And this is primarily what I want to look at in this sidebar here. So God says, "I'll destroy this people." And he says to Moses, I'll make out of you a great nation. And Moses comes back and he negotiates with God. He says, "No, just a minute. What was this all about to begin with? I know we're only 18 months out or 24 months out, but what was this all about to begin with? It was to show your power." He said to me, "Remember, go down to see Pharaoh, and Pharaoh will know that I am God and my power." So just a minute. We can't just wipe them out, because what would the Egyptians say? Egyptians say, "Yeah, well, our gods were right in the end. Right? They got a calf there." And that was the end of them. Exodus 32:11 and Deuteronomy 5:5. Moses actually got down on the ground and pleaded. First of all, with the temptation that God said, "Oh, well, I can be the nation." No, that's good, eh? Because, of course, Jesus faced that one. He said, "Well, I'll show you all the kingdoms of the world if you bow down and worship me." This is a major temptation. No, maybe it's just me. I don't know. Maybe it's not you. But somebody said, "Look, I'm going to make you into a big, great nation. You're going to be the guy." Moses would have nothing of it. He got right down to saying, "But look, Lord, what about the covenant? What about the reason for doing this to begin with? What's the statement? I know these people are that way, but..." And I know they sin, but what's the statement to the nations? Now, eventually, of course, God finally said, after 400 or 500 years of mercy, "No, you've got to go. I'm done with it." And the Babylonians came in and tore the place down and took them away. So that was a lot of time elapsed between this first major moment. So the second time was at the border of the land. And so they reject the Lord and say, "We're not going to go in." They had this moment of lack of faith. And the same thing happens, notice, in Numbers chapter 14 and verse 13. God said to Moses at the mountain with the calf, he said, "I will make you into a great nation." And now he says to Moses, "I will make you into an even stronger and greater nation than they." So in case Moses would have thought, well, maybe he wouldn't have been a great nation like this, but at least he would have been his own nation, God is saying, no, "I will make you into a greater and stronger nation than they." And the words are specific. And the other thing is that, where did we have the covenant here? Was it in that chapter 32, Exodus chapter 32? But remember, God said to Abraham last week, "So you're going to go down. I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And I'm a covenant. I'm the God of the covenant. So therefore, this is about the covenant." And so he brings that back up. "I will make you a great and stronger nation." He talks about the covenant. Then he talks about that the Egyptians will hear about it, so you have to forgive. And he adds that piece in chapter 14, Numbers chapter 14 and verse 19. You have to forgive this people for their sins. So now he takes upon himself a priestly role and stands between the wrath of God and the people, his people, and becomes the figure of Christ. So we see in two situations here how Moses responds. He has no concern about himself at all. His concern is for God, for the purpose of God and the covenant that he was there representing. Now, in Numbers chapter 12, we mentioned this before, there's a family challenge here, which is, I think, really quite peculiar. And I made a bit of a thing about this Nubian princess. But Josephus said that he brought back a Nubian princess as a peace settlement for the Ethiopians. And now, of course, here he is. His brother and sister began to talk against Moses because of his Cushite wife. So here's the historical connection here. Here's the link. So we can assume that the history of Josephus was probably not just legendary. It was the fact that Moses had, and that he had actually gone back to Egypt, brought the people out, but picked up his Nubian wife and brought her out with him. Didn't take her to Midian. So obviously he brought her out with the rest of the people. So he's there, and it's his wife. And so they couldn't find anything, I guess. They're trying to find something to picket their brother about. And so they went after this Nubian wife. You know, why did you, you know, you've got this non-Israelite woman and so on. And he said, yeah, but I got a Midianite too, but you got this Cushite wife and so on. And by the way, has the Lord only spoken through Moses? Why would he speak to somebody who's got a Cushite wife? I don't know. And the Lord hears this in chapter 12 and verse 2. Now, verse 3, it says, Moses was a humble man. Well, here it is. Now we get it. He's learned something here, hasn't he? What God can do with a humble man. He wasn't humble when he went after the Egyptian in his first 40 years. He assumed that he would be able to deliver the people. And God had a plan for him, but it was 40 years later. Now, Moses was a very humble man, verse 3 of chapter 12, more humble than anyone else on the face of the earth. Wow. I guess that's why we look at Moses, because we're looking at the very heart of God. So, he says to Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, come on outside, all three of you, basically what he said. And so the three of them were there, and they came out, and they're standing outside. And the Lord came down in verse 5, and a pillar of cloud, and stood in the entrance of the tent, and summoned Aaron and Miriam, and both of them stepped forward. He said, listen to my words. When a prophet of the Lord is among you, I reveal myself to him in visions. I speak to him in dreams. But this is not true of my servant Moses. But you're talking about Moses here. You're messing with Moses. You're messing with my man. You are in big trouble. I don't talk to Moses or relate to Moses like any other person on earth. This is not true of Moses. He is faithful in all my house. When I speak to him, I speak to him face to face. I don't speak in riddles. I speak clearly to him. He sees the form of God. What a statement that is about Moses. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my man, Moses? Now that would just freeze us in our tracks to think about that. That here we were actually looking at and talking to and criticizing and talking against the very heart of God. The man who was the humblest man on earth who God spoke to face to face. But what did Moses do? He went into his mediation role. The anger of the Lord burns against them. The cloud's there, and Miriam was leprous like snow. And Aaron turns around and sees her leprous. And he says to Moses, in realizing that the terror of the situation and what they had done, please, my Lord, do not hold against us the sin we have so foolishly committed. Do not let her be like a stillborn infant, leprous for the rest of her life. And Moses said, well, oh Lord, please heal her in verse 13. But it didn't happen right away. It happened after a few days. And she had to go out of the camp. And the Lord replied to Moses, and he said, well, I know you want your sister healed. And I know this is a very big issue to you. It was because of her that you ended up in Pharaoh's house and so on. If her father had spit in her face, would she not have been in disgrace for 7 days? And this is what she'd done to her brother Moses. confine her outside the camp for 7 days, and after that she can be brought back. So there's great mercy even here, when we might figure that there would have been summary execution with Miriam. And so she was confined out the camp, outside the camp for 7 days, and the people didn't move on. They just waited for Miriam till she came back. And then she came back, and she was whole and clean. Now, Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, another kind of major challenge to leadership. And there's one word I've outlined here, because I think this is really, really important in relation to how this came down. They had the confrontation. The people of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, and so on, the priests and whoever was involved in that group. And so Moses said, come and stand before the Lord tomorrow. So again, this idea of summary execution was not there within the thinking. This was Moses saying this. It wasn't say God said come. Moses said, you come back here tomorrow and we'll see what's going to happen. Now, the interesting thing about that is that that was the phrase that Moses used in Egypt when he was dealing with Pharaoh. He says, tomorrow about the same time. You know, tomorrow about the same time. He said that a number of times. So what I guess we need to understand is that if Moses was standing there saying, tomorrow, you better look out. There was something going to happen. But at the same time, brothers and sisters, Korah, Dathan, and Abiram had 24 hours to think about this. That's what I see in the mercy that was underlying all of these laws and all of these outcomes. You come tomorrow. And they did. They shouldn't have. They should have stayed home. That's how arrogant they were. That's how far off they were. But that's how merciful Moses was, to give them a little time. I think that's what happened there anyway. Now, Meribah, we read this tonight in chapter 20. I remember I mentioned to you last week, for those of you who are here, that there are certain things in scriptures that I confess I always had trouble with, and I guess I always will, and I still do, and so on. And why God was going to kill Moses because over his son, and finally his wife circumcises his son Gershom, and then God leaves him alone. Why was God going to? And we asked those questions when we were doing the readings, and I must say that quite often somebody would say because. So yeah, but why was it? Just because. You knew that when it was just because, you better move on, because there was some issue with that that maybe wasn't really to be discussed. I don't know. But why did this happen to Moses in Numbers chapter 20? Now remember, this was at the end of the wilderness wanderings. This was now as they were coming up north into Moab, camping and moving up towards Jericho. And most of Deuteronomy comes into play there. And a number of these events come into play. Now remember that the whole entire old generation was now gone. And here they come, and they're grumbling. This is the new generation, right? That they're saying, verse 5, why did you bring us up out of Egypt to this terrible place? There's no grain, there's no figs, there's no grapevines, pomegranates. Who told you about grapevines and pomegranates and stuff like that? Most of these people were under 20. 15 years old, 10 years old when they were in Egypt. Well, the parents, I guess, have been telling them about the pomegranates in Egypt. It was still there after 38 years, embedded in their mind. What had the parents been teaching them? Because they seemed to know a lot more about Egypt than they did about the law. No water to drink. What about all the miracles where they had been provided for? What were they teaching them? And Moses and Aaron were, I can just imagine that Moses was really, really ticked off. And after all this time, and you're coming to me saying, well, there may not be water, but we can deal with that. The Lord will deal with it. So Moses and Aaron go to the assembly at the entrance of the tent of meeting and fell face down, and the glory of the Lord appeared to them. And now look at the wording here. The Lord said to Moses, take the staff. Well, that was the one he held up over the Red Sea. That was the one he held up when they were dealing with the Amalekites. Take the staff. That's the one he threw down in front of Pharaoh. So he takes the staff. It all makes sense. And you and your brother Aaron, gather the assembly together, speak to that rock. Okay, so there's just, speak to that rock, but take the staff and speak to the rock. And before the eyes of the people, and it will pour out its water. And notice this, and I think this is, comes out in all of your versions, you will bring water out of the rock for the community. Now, you're putting this together, and the Lord says, you and Aaron, take the staff, go and speak, but you will bring the water out of the rock for the community and the livestock. So Moses took the staff, just as he was commanded, just as he was commanded. He and Aaron gathered the assembly together in front of the rock, just as he had commanded. And Moses speaks to the people, not to the rock, which, you know, I'm saying I'd let him have it. And then that we must bring water out of this rock. That's exactly what the Lord said. But then he raises his arm and strikes the rock twice. God never said anything about striking the rock. He said about the rock, about the staff, and so on. Now we know that, well, the old Bible stories and Sunday school stories, that about these rocks, sometimes in that land you could beat on a rock or fracture a rock and actually open it up and water would come out. But I doubt that there would have been enough to feed a million people or to water a million people and their livestock. This was major water. The Lord said to Moses in verse 12, because you did not trust me enough to honor me as holy in the sight of the Israelites, you will not bring this community into the land I gave them. What a price to pay for one slip of the tongue. He wasn't going to go into the land. Moses was going to be a Gershom. Remember, he named his son Gershom. It meant stranger. He said, I'm a stranger. I'm an alien in a foreign land. He was in Egypt. He came to realize that. And Hebrews chapter 11 tells us that. He said, no, I'm a Hebrew. I can't. He was an alien. He went to Midian and he had a son. And he said, I'm an alien in a strange land. I'm a foreigner. Here he was in Moab. Just about ready to go in. He's still an alien, a stranger in a foreign land. There's a number of lessons, I think, that really are important here. One of them, as Moses would have agreed with me when I said, you can take the boy out of Egypt, but you can't take Egypt out of the boy. That is an eternal truth, and it's something that, again, is a clear and ever-present danger for all of us. You can go and haul the whole nation out of Egypt, and Moses never really had to worry about the Egyptian army coming and taking his people back to Egypt. He had to worry about them going back there in their hearts. And they did. And here they were. And I want you to turn to Psalm chapter 106. And it's what I call community culpability. Moses suffered for his indiscretion. Verse 29 of Psalm 106. They provoked the Lord to anger by their wicked deeds, and a plague broke out upon them. Phinehas, of course, stood and intervened, and the plague was checked. And this was credited to him as righteousness for endless generations to come. By the waters of Meribah, they angered the Lord. They angered the Lord. And trouble came to Moses. See, when we start to create problems from our complaining and our harassing and all of those things that we do that cause other people to sin. Jesus said that. You know, the offenses will come, but woe to those by whom those offenses come. And this is the lesson of Meribah. It wasn't just that they were messing with the Lord's men. It was the fact that they actually caused Moses to do that. And I know we can't say the people, and he couldn't say the people made me do that, because Moses bore his own grief. But there is this thing that I call community culpability, and we need to be ever vigilant about that, that we don't cause people to sin, because it looks like we bear the same burden of guilt. Just a thought. They came to the border of the land. There was a new leader, Joshua, and there was a new arrangement that was going to be an arrangement between Joshua and the high priest and the Urim and the Thummim. This was how God was going to speak to his people and to communicate with his people now for the next number of years. He would start speaking again directly to Samuel, of course, but the arrangement now was with the high priest and the commander, Joshua. Chapter 11 of Hebrews said his eye was not dim. His eye was not dim, but he saw it afar off. Basically, it was by faith that Moses actually saw the land. Let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 34. A stranger now, beholding the land afar off. Verse 7 of chapter 34, Moses was 120 years old when he died, yet his eyes were not weak, nor his strength gone. And this was to remind us that Moses could see it physically. His eyes were good. He was 120 years of age. He obviously didn't have any cataracts, which seems to be popular today. He could see the whole land. He could see the Mediterranean Sea. He had good eyesight, and his natural force was not abated, as it says here. He got to see the land, but it was by faith. Deuteronomy chapter 18, because all of this, brothers and sisters, spoke of the prophet like Moses who would come and who would lead us and all of God's people into the promised land. I will rise up in verse 18 of Deuteronomy 18, a prophet like you from among their brothers. I will put my words in his mouth, and he will tell them everything I command him, and so on. This was the great foreshadowing of the Lord, which Moses clearly could see from his distance. And this little summation of Harry Tennant's, and these words again are specific in the text. It was the 40th year in the 11th month and the first day when Moses began to speak. And there's this little biographical or topographical note in the account which reads, there were 11 days journey from Horeb to Kadesh Barnea. There was an 11-day journey that they had at the beginning, and they didn't make it. They spent 38 years wandering around in the desert, 40 years, and never completed a simple 11-day jaunt north up to the borders of the Promised Land. They fell by the way. Herein lies the powerful exhortation. It is possible to spend an entire lifetime getting nowhere. I love this kind of summation here. a lifetime starting from mother's womb and ending in Mother Earth. I don't like his use of the word Mother Earth there, but so be it. And nothing. Nothing comes of it. What a waste of time. No sense of purpose, he says. Merely filling in the time between birth and death. What a terrible, tragic waste of a life that God has given to us. And all the amazing things that and the possibilities that are there. Such is the accomplishment of the many, he says. The few journeying with their God. That's where power is. That's where strength is. And that's where we can see how God can do so much with people who are nothing and can make them something. They are caught up in the external purposes which reaches far beyond the little summer of man's life. These people who walk with God. Such a man was Moses.